it can dismantle in seconds. My teenage son is a far better skeptic than about 75% of the people I went to college with, including several straight-A engineering students. I once worked with a woman who was well-educated and would probably be described as intelligent by most people. Smart as she may have been, however, she was absolutely convinced that a Russian girl had X-ray vision and could see inside of people with her bare eyes. My coworker read about the claim and swallowed it, hook, line, and sinker. If true, this extraordinary power could be easily verified with credible scientific testing. But it never has been confirmed, so it makes no sense to believe it. My former colleague was typical of the highly educated, weak skeptic that is all too common today. She had a sharp mind and achieved more academically than most. But in school, she apparently was taught only what to think and not how to think. History offers numerous examples of very smart people who believed very goofy things. Today, Isaac Newton is considered by many to be no less than the greatest scientist who ever lived. It's tough to argue against him. Toiling in the 1600s, Newton managed to invent calculus and figure out how stars and planets move about in the universe. But he didn't spend all his time on the work that would make him so famous. This undeniable genius also devoted much of his time and energy to the Christian apocalypse claim. He seriously thought he could calculate the exact date of a supernatural doomsday, and did come up with one. You might not want to make any plans for the year 2060. Newton was a great mathematician, but not a good skeptic. Had he been, he might have recognized early on that his time would be better spent on other things. We can cut him some slack, given the time he lived in, of course, but what other great things might the brain of Isaac Newton have contributed to science if it had been protected by the force field of skepticism? Fast forward to today, and one wonders what contributions to science in the world won't happen because some of the 21st century's brightest minds are distracted or derailed by bad ideas that skeptical thinking could easily brush aside if applied. Why do you suppose it is that the world's professional astronomers spend virtually no time on astrology and UFOs? The reason is that they are good enough skeptics to know that their efforts will be better spent elsewhere, because nothing is likely to come from trying to work out the influence of Jupiter on the love lives of people born in September, or determining if the alien crew survived the Roswell UFO crash or died on impact. There is an invaluable life lesson in this for you. Everyone loves to say that hard work is the key to success, but few explain that hard work is only part of it. What you direct all that effort at matters a lot, too. You can work 12-hour days, 7 days a week, year after year. But if it's all toward proving that some houses are haunted, you are probably wasting your time because skeptics have shown over and over that there is no good evidence and there are no compelling reasons to believe it. It's safe to assume, for example, that the hardest working psychic in history has contributed less to the world's understanding of the human brain than, say, one lecture by one random psychology professor at any university. This is not to suggest that some things should be off limits for inquiring minds. Everything is worth a thought, or taking a peek at, because one never knows what discoveries lie just beyond the reach of current understanding. I'm not for banning ghost hunters or making UFO watching illegal. People should be free to think whatever they want, and to follow their passions where they lead. However, it is in one's own interests to be reasonable and realistic when deciding what to pursue and devote limited time and energy to. For example, the Yeti, or abominable snowman, might be real, it's possible, so I suppose you could spend a career looking for it. But if discovering an unknown species is your dream, then it makes much more sense to look for new arthropods or microbes in deep caves or in the Pacific abyss than it does to hunt a giant primate in Tibet. A basic skeptical analysis of the Yeti claim and review of all available evidence make it clear that it is among the longest of long shots, to say the least. However, based on past efforts, it's hard to imagine not finding a few previously unknown arthropods and microbes if one looks in the environments they are likely to be in. Skepticism takes on all comers. I hope that it is encouraging for young people in particular to recognize that one doesn't have to read 1,000 books or spend 10 years in graduate school in order to become a razor-sharp skeptic who is not easily fooled by false claims and inane ideas. Learning relevant facts and having a general understanding of how the universe works can help explain away many bogus beliefs, of course. But far more important than reading, research, and schooling is committing to the skeptical attitude in the first place. It's about having the will to ask the necessary questions and the courage to walk away if the answers don't measure up. It's about withholding belief until you know. The process of skeptical thinking works very well even when you don't know much or anything at all about the particular claim. For example, there are so many weird alternative medicine products and weight loss gadgets on the market today that I can't keep up with them. But it doesn't matter. If someone approaches me later today with something I've never heard of, let's call it the bejeepers pill, that is guaranteed to prevent and cure cancer, I already know what to ask and what to look out for because I'm a good skeptic. I don't have to become an expert on the bejeepers pill and understand everything about its chemical makeup and specific history in order to approach the claim in a sensible manner. Here's how it would most likely go down from my side of the conversation alone. Prevent and cure cancer? Wow, that must be an amazing pill you have there. By the way, I'm curious, what are your credentials in the medical field? How exciting this must be for you. If your pill works, it means you will be responsible for saving millions of lives each year. You will become one of the richest and most famous people in the world, one of the greatest scientists in history. A Nobel Prize in medicine is guaranteed. You must have been so excited when the test results came in. You did do scientific double-blind tests on the pill, right? Double-blind test or trial means neither the researchers nor the patients know which test subjects get the real bejeepers pill and which ones get sugar pills. This helps to prevent the results from being contaminated by bias. And surely you publish the results in a respected medical journal, right? But I don't understand. Why haven't you done proper testing of the pill or published anything in a journal? Don't you think you need to do that before you start selling it to people? How will anyone know if it really works or if it's just more medical quackery? Hold on, my friend, you are changing the subject. Why are you suddenly telling me random stories about people who you say took this pill and got better? Of course you know that mere stories about a few people don't prove anything, right? Even the worst, most ineffective rip-off medicines in the world have stories like that to back them up. Hey, wait, why are you leaving? Well, okay, it's been nice talking to you. Please get back to me when you can prove that your pill works. The ability of a good skeptic to mount a respectable challenge to virtually any unusual claim that comes along is amazing when you think about it. One does not need to be an expert on the particular subject to at least put up a sound skeptical defense against empty claims and unlikely beliefs. I'm just one guy, but I do pretty well in discussions, debates, with the endless parade of people who try to convince me that weird things are true. I don't have to be smarter than them or even more informed on the specific topic in question. I just have to be a good skeptic. I am frequently a guest on call-in radio shows, for example, and I never know what will come up next. Callers have asked me about everything from UFOs and the moon landing hoax to Laetril and the lost continent of Atlantis. But I feel that I've managed to field every challenge to date very well. A strong skeptic core enables one to take on all comers and do very well in the wild, dark forest of extraordinary and unproven claims. Although knowledge is important, skepticism is not a body of knowledge. It's a way of thinking. It's less about something you know and more about something you do. Never give up. Never surrender. Becoming a good skeptic is about making a promise to yourself that you will not be an easy victim. Sometimes you really have to view this as war, not against people, but against lame ideas. Tell yourself that you won't go down without a fight when people try to convince you to believe in outlandish things that they can't back up with very good evidence. Some people who try to push irrational beliefs on others do it with a strange enthusiasm. Some can be relentless about it. They are like starved zombies banging on the door in search of their next meal. Their goal is to bring you into their undead legion of the unthinking. Don't let it happen. Don't let them in. Better they and their vacuous claims splat against your force field. Nudge these people and their claims into the meat grinder of the scientific process and see how well they hold up. Ask good questions and demand plenty of evidence. Stand up for yourself, always. Think for yourself, always. And whatever you do, don't let them in. The Green Troll in a Red Dress. When you are confronted with a weird idea, it is important to keep in mind a simple statement popularized by the late astronomer Carl Sagan. Extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence. Remembering this when it counts can save you time, money, embarrassment, and possibly even your life. There is great power in these five words, enough to slay dragons and repel the crooks and crazies. To put it into action, the first thing we need to do is to assess the size of the claim so that we can assess the amount of evidence that we need to accept it. No, put away the scales and tape measure. A general estimate is all that is needed. For this, a little or a lot are fine units of measure in most cases. It's about seeking a rough balance, that's all. We don't demand mountains of evidence for every claim anyone makes about anything, of course. That would be overkill and would waste too much time. For example, if for no particular reason I tell you that I saw a blue car driving on the road near my house yesterday, you would be right to go ahead and believe me. Seeing a blue car is not an extraordinary claim. There are millions of blue cars. It's reasonable and likely to be true that I saw one. And so what if I did? It's not a big deal. It's not like I'm asking you to attend my weekly blue car sighting meetings and make a monetary donation on behalf of the Blue Car Fund of America. You can probably go ahead and trust me on this one. But what if I make a very different claim? What if I say that yesterday I saw a winged troll with green skin wearing a spectacular red dress and playing God Bless America on a jewel-encrusted harmonica while flying around in my backyard? Are you going to accept my claim and believe it happened? What if I also tell you that this particular troll is short on cash and needs $100 per week, which I have been authorized to collect for him? I hope that you wouldn't trust this story without more effort to prove its veracity on my part. It's an extraordinary claim, so it demands extraordinary evidence, right? You don't have to disprove the troll story. That might be impossible. We don't know with absolute certainty that winged, green-skinned trolls do not exist. Maybe they do, and if they do exist, we don't know that they don't need money. We can't even say for sure whether or not they look great dressed in red, but that's okay. Doubt is enough. Being a good skeptic doesn't mean you have to know everything. It certainly doesn't mean you have to disprove every claim believers make. The burden of proof is on me for making the claim in the first place. For a whopper of a tale like this one, I should have to produce tons of very good evidence if I want sensible people to believe me. Sadly, of course, if I wanted to and was willing to work at it a bit, I have no doubt that I could find a few weak skeptics somewhere who would believe in my green troll wearing the hot dress, no evidence required. Do you doubt it? It's always a good time for skepticism. If someone were to tell you that he has a time machine, an extraordinary claim, if ever there was one, it could only make sense to ask him to prove it. No fancy talk, no hype, no interesting stories, and no intriguing promises. Just a lot of good, solid evidence. But first, what is this thing called evidence that skeptics like me are always talking about? It's simply stuff that helps make the case, things that support a claim. It can come in many forms, from photographs to a strand of hair to an eyewitness account. Not all evidence is equal, however. Some evidence is so weak it may as well not be there, and some is so strong that it qualifies as proof. One thing is consistent, however. When it comes to extraordinary claims, the more evidence, the better. For the particular claim about a time machine, you might ask your buddy to bring a live baby triceratops back from the past or go into the future a few centuries and fetch the cures for cancer and malaria. But even those efforts would not be perfect proof. Maybe he obtained a live triceratops from a successful cloning effort using DNA harvested out of fossilized bones. Maybe he already had the cures for cancer and malaria here in our time and lied about getting them from future. But this sort of evidence would be so difficult to come by without a time machine that it would make the claim much more credible and well worth investigating further. However, what if the alleged time traveler brings back a message from the people of 24th century that warns us to protect the environment and learn to live in peace with one another? Yawn. Not good evidence. Even worse, he might argue that he shouldn't have to prove something so special and wonderful. It's rude to even ask for evidence, he might say. You should just believe what he says, and by the way, he needs some money to maintain his time machine and fund more trips. This is the point at which good skeptics smile and walk away. Believers say the darndest things. It is always important to keep the big picture in mind when trying to think critically about extraordinary claims. Don't allow a person trying to sell you a freaky belief to slip in a false premise on you in order to make the conclusion seem more reasonable. A typical line goes like this. As everyone knows, an extraordinary number of ships and planes vanish mysteriously and inexplicably in the area known as the Bermuda Triangle. Therefore, there must be substantial paranormal activity occurring there. Never forget that everything a person making a strange claim says should be analyzed and challenged by your skeptical brain. Forget for the moment that supernatural or paranormal powers may or may not be at work in the Bermuda Triangle. The first thing to question would be the claim that an extraordinary number of ships and planes go missing without explanation in the area called the Bermuda Triangle. One might check in with the people who would pay close attention to such a trend and know more than anyone about it, like the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Coast Guard. I did. More on that in Chapter 3. You might also question the very existence of something called the Bermuda Triangle. Just because people talk about it or it shows up in some slick TV documentary doesn't mean it is necessarily real. Did you know that no such triangular region shows up on any official government or military maps or on any other serious maps made by credible map-making companies such as Rand McNally or National Geographic? No group of professional and qualified cartographers or scientists has ever agreed on any boundaries for this place. Just saying something doesn't make it so. Belief peddlers also like to throw in something that is true but does not prove their original claim just because it sounds good and might make them seem more credible. This verbal sleight of hand is common, so watch out for it. If X is obviously true and someone attaches it to Y in order to come up with Z as a conclusion, then we always need to make sure that X and Y really have something to do with one another in the first place. Like I tell my kids all the time, one tiny careless mistake in a long math equation makes the final answer wrong. You can't afford to be sloppy and rush over any of the steps or variables, both in math and in skepticism. Many people who push paranormal and supernatural claims are also in the habit of distorting reality to try to make their case. Don't let them. When someone says that everyone else believes her claim, pause and think about it. Is that true? Everyone? I doubt it. People are in the habit of saying they proved and they discovered. You need to know who they is before you allow yourself to be impressed by them. Don't be misled by inconsistent skeptics. Many people who can't resist spending their money on medical quackery might happen to reject psychic readings, for example, and vice versa. I met a person who laughs at the moon landing hoax claim, but does believe that the U.S. government has been reverse engineering alien spaceships at Area 51. Always listen carefully to the entire sales pitch, and remember that no one person is always right about everything. Finally, don't let anyone inflate one wild claim with other wild claims in an attempt to overwhelm you with stories, data, or arguments. Believers often inject secondary unproven claims into the mix in order to make it seem as if they are building a strong case when they are not. Call them on it. Pause the conversation and ask about each claim. For example, if someone tried to tell me that invisible rays from the moon have been making a significant impact on how mediums talk to the dead, my response would be, "We'll get to mediums soon enough, but first tell me about these moon rays. What are they? Does NASA know about them? Why not?" If someone said that psychics have determined that horoscopes are 67% more accurate on Thursdays than on Mondays, I first would ask for an explanation of why psychics should be viewed as a reliable source about the claim before I entertained anything about horoscopes. Evidence? We don't need no stinking evidence. Consider it a warning sign whenever someone downplays the need for evidence and insists that it's unnecessary. Faith is enough is a common claim. When you hear this, immediately go to DEFCON 2, signal red alert, and raise shields. When they say, "Just trust me," it's time to throttle up the skepticism and man your battle stations. Relying on faith might sound sweet and sensible to some ears because it's heavily promoted as something positive and reliable. But the truth is that faith is really nothing more than pretending to know something that you don't know. It's worse than bad thinking, it's anti-thinking. Faith as a means to figuring things out, coming to a conclusion, and justifying a position on something is the opposite of thinking like a scientist. It's a terrible way to make your way through life because it can lead you to believe just about anything. The crucial problem for those who say faith is an acceptable way of approaching unusual claims is figuring out where to draw the line. When exactly are we supposed to rely on faith instead of thinking? If I decide to have faith and accept the claims of some astrologer or doomsday prophet, should I also have faith and accept claims that gargoyles and fairies are real? Should I use faith to believe in mediums who say they talk to dead people, even though they can't prove it? What's the difference? If blind trust works for one thing, why not for everything? I come in peace. When discussing an extraordinary claim with a believer, I recommend being friendly about it. It's usually better for everyone. Just don't be so nice that you let yourself become a punching bag. You have to stand up for your brain, and you have to work to keep the conversation somewhere inside the general vicinity of honesty and reality. Many people who believe weird things veer off into fantasy land every chance they get and try to take you with them. They usually seem to do this without even realizing it, so I tend to be forgiving about it. No matter how strange a conversation may become, however, I never assume people are lying or are hopelessly stupid. Maybe they don't realize how badly they are abusing logic and torturing common sense. Maybe they haven't given the subject much thought and are just winging it. Maybe they are hyper-competitive and would rather spew crazy talk than risk going silent and losing by default. Regardless of why they do it, however, it is the responsibility of a good skeptic to keep things as sensible as possible. Remember that you're not rude for doing nothing more than asking people to explain, defend, or prove a belief that they are trying to talk you into accepting. I would never go to the home of someone who believed in an imminent judgment day, knock on the door and demand proof that the world is about to expire. But if people come to my door and declare that these are the final days, then it's open season on their claim. I can ask questions and demand all the evidence I want. You are never wrong for being skeptical of an unusual and important claim, and you are never a jerk for challenging a claim when someone dumps it in your lap. Just because others think it's the greatest thing ever doesn't mean you have to suspend your thinking. Besides, if their belief can't hold up to a little scrutiny, then you are probably doing them a favor by at least presenting them with the opportunity to reconsider their conclusions. However, if a belief is doing harm to someone, then that's plenty of justification to challenge at any time, regardless of context. It sometimes helps to remind believers that true claims have nothing to fear from skepticism. If believers refuse to think critically about their claims, then call them on it. Why are you reluctant to challenge a claim that you say is so important and obviously true? What are you afraid of? One can easily avoid being too harsh to sensitive ears by softening the delivery of a skeptical challenge. You don't even have to tell them anything. Simply asking questions works wonders. Blasting a believer with the blunt force of facts, declarations, and accusations can feel like a mean-spirited attack. Questions tend to feel much gentler. Here are some hypothetical exchanges between a believer and a skeptic to help illustrate the point. Believer: it's amazing how accurate my horoscope was today. It hit right on the mark. Skeptic: but was the horoscope vague? If it was specific, couldn't it just be a coincidence? After all, how many times has your horoscope been wrong? A few hits in the context of thousands or millions of misses don't really prove anything, right? Oh, and how does astrology work anyway? Is it by gravity or what? If so, exactly how does the gravity of a planet or star influence a person's career and love life? Wow, that psychic knew so much about me. Are you sure the psychic really knew important and unique things about you? Or is it possible that the psychic threw out a bunch of educated guesses and then read your verbal and physical reactions to them? Is it possible that you are remembering a few of the guesses that seemed to be correct while forgetting the many more guesses that were way off the mark? It's a miracle that I survived cancer. I'm glad you were okay, but are you sure this was something that we should call a miracle in the sense that it was a supernatural event? Was a doctor treating your disease? Were you taking medication, getting chemotherapy? If so, why are you saying it was a miracle instead of medical science that saved you? Cancer is often deadly, of course, but millions of people do survive it every year. Is every case of a person beating cancer a miracle? I had a dream last night, and it came true. Worldwide, how many dreams do people have every year? A lot, right? It's got to be in the hundreds of billions. So doesn't it seem likely that out of all these dreams, many thousands of them are bound to match up with future events, just by chance? Also, is it possible that you might have been influenced by the dream and subconsciously or consciously done things to make it come true? I saw a ghost last night. How do you know that it was a ghost that you saw? How can you be sure that it wasn't some natural thing that your brain misinterpreted as supernatural? How do you know it wasn't your imagination? It's common for smart, normal, sane, and honest people to see things that aren't really there. It happens all the time. Given the way our brains work, don't you agree that it's not reasonable to completely trust eyewitness accounts when it comes to important or unusual things, such as seeing a murder or encountering a ghost? What if I told you I saw Elvis at a shopping mall yesterday? Would you believe me? Why not? A teaspoon of natural extract of fried gopher nipples cured my flu. Sounds yummy, but how can you be sure that it cured your flu? Maybe it was just a combination of time and your body's own defenses that did it. I've been sick with the flu and it went away despite the fact that I never took fried gopher nipples for it or any other alternative medicine. Wrap it up. Those who try to convince you that skepticism is negative, pessimistic, or destructive are either profoundly clueless on the matter or they are being deceptive because they hope to sell you something that you don't need. Skepticism is positive, optimistic, and constructive. It's the invaluable defensive weapon that you want and need every day of your life. The only people who should not be good skeptics are those who have a deep desire to be a victim, to be foolish, to waste time and money, and perhaps to risk their life for nothing. Three things make it abundantly clear why it is wise to be a good skeptic. 1. There are dishonest people in the world who are ready to trick you out of your money by getting you to believe claims that are very likely to be untrue because the evidence is weak or non-existent. 2. Thanks to science, we now understand more than enough about how the human brain works to know that we have to be very careful when trying to determine what is real and what is not, what is true and what is false. If you are human, you can and will be fooled by your own brain in various ways many times throughout your life. Being a good skeptic is the only way to reduce these missteps and minimize harm from them. 3. Smart doesn't mean safe. No matter how brilliant you may be, don't fall into the trap of assuming that intelligence alone will keep you safe from nonsense beliefs and clever frauds. One of the most important messages in this book is that we are all vulnerable. Arrogance can lead any one of us right into the open arms of those who peddle irrational junk. We must be on guard all the time. Many wacko claims are customized and packaged in ways that make them seem reasonable to reasonable people. Some may be crafted precisely to appeal to people who are exceptionally smart. Even worse, crazy claims and bogus beliefs don't always come to us from creepy strangers. They are often delivered to us by trusted loved ones, people we admire, and respected authority figures. Good skeptics know to always be ready to think, regardless of where they are or whom they are listening to. You are free to believe before you think if you wish, but just know that taking such a stance in life puts you at risk. You may end up as one more human pinata, a fat, juicy target of opportunity for all those eager to fill your head with their baloney or empty your pockets in exchange for lies. They will come for you again and again, and they will hammer you relentlessly with delusions and deceptions. The force field of skepticism is the only thing between you and them. Keep it running at full power. Good thinking. Weak skepticism is perhaps the greatest unrecognized global crisis of all. Every day, people waste time, throw away money, suffer, and even die because they fail to think like a scientist. The quality, strength, and consistency of your skeptical thinking will likely have a direct impact on your safety, success, and quality of life. Doing your best to stay free and clear from bad ideas and bad people who would take advantage of you should be a top priority. Anyone can think like a scientist. It doesn't matter who you are, how old you are, or how smart you are. The key questions are, 1, do you have the courage? And 2, do you care enough about your life to protect it from the nonsense and the madness? Skepticism is the path toward a lean and efficient life, one that affords more time and energy for romance, family, friends, fun, and creativity. Think and get the most out of your life. Think and be fully human. Chapter 2. Pay a visit to the strange thing that lives inside your head. Once you understand something about how our brains operate, and how easily they lead us to see, hear, and feel things that aren't there, believe in things that don't exist, and think things that make no sense, you might never again find the courage to walk out of your front door. I have been paying close attention to the work of psychologists and brain scientists for many years, and at times their discoveries have left me reeling. Unfortunately, most people know little or nothing about how the brain operates, so they make incorrect assumptions about its reliability. The brutal truth is that human brains do a poor job of separating truth from fiction. This leads to many false beliefs. Therefore, it's only wise to make at least a minimal effort to understand the brain and be on guard against its deceptive ways. Many of the weird yet routine processes of the human brain are not only extremely interesting but have direct relevance to the safety and quality of our lives as well. It's like we're all sharing our bodies with another person, somebody called Brain, who we barely know. This odd roommate is eccentric, is secretive, and doesn't ask for our consent when it goes about most of its business. But it does mean well, and performs important work that we literally could not live without. So, before we address the problems in our heads, let's make sure we appreciate the human brain for all the good it does. The brain processes all the tasting, smelling, hearing, seeing, and touching that we do throughout our lives. It regulates breathing and blood circulation. It stands guard over us, ready to alert us to injuries and other problems via a messaging system called pain. And of course, it's the place where all our thoughts and memories live. It is the beginning and end of us all. No brain, no you. Think of what human brains have accomplished to date. They imagined and then made wood and stone tools that allowed our ancestors to rise above challenging environments and overcome stronger, faster predators. They created music, humor, and countless fantastic stories and ideas, some of which reach beyond even the limits of our universe. About 80 to 100 billion cells called neurons make up this amazing 3-pound organ. These cells are connected to each other by some 100 trillion little structures called synapses. Electrical and chemical messages fly around in the brain constantly, making it a nonstop hub of action. Even during sleep, the brain keeps working for us. The problem is that our brains go about many of their duties in very strange ways that most people are unaware of. But you had better clue in fast, because having at least a basic understanding of what that strange thing inside your head is up to is absolutely necessary to being a good skeptic. People who have no idea how human vision and memory work, for example, are far more likely to see an alien spaceship in the sky or a ghost down the hall and then confidently remember the event in great detail and with confidence. Because of their lack of awareness, it may never occur to them that natural processes of the brain present a far more reasonable explanation for what they thought they saw and what they think they remember. Those who understand that our brains don't play fair when it comes to assessing arguments and evidence are far less likely to spend years of their lives clinging to lies, lame ideas, and bad beliefs. Without some basic knowledge of how stories seduce our brains, you might run right by a pile of solid scientific evidence in order to snuggle up with one tall tale. I thought I was well informed about cognitive biases, memory flaws, hallucinations, and so on, but while researching my book, 50 Popular Beliefs That People Think Are True, I was repeatedly shocked by new things I learned from reviewing scientific research and talking to experts. The inside of a human skull is a far freakier environment than I had ever imagined. That realization helped to inspire this book. I kept thinking, people need to know about this. Science is revealing more and more every day about how our brains work and how they deceive us both in unusual circumstances as well as in routine everyday life. It can be a rude awakening to realize that you are walking around in a reality that your brain created for you, a reality that can never be trusted completely. Remember not to trust your memory. Did you know that you can't trust even your most precious memories? They may come to you in great detail and feel 100% accurate, but it doesn't matter. They easily could be partial or total lies that your brain is telling you. Really, the personal past that your brain is supposed to be keeping safe for you is not what you think it is. Your memories are pieces and batches of information that your brain cobbles together and serves up to you, not to present the past as accurately as possible, but to provide you with information that you will likely find to be useful in the present. Functional value, not accuracy, is the priority. Your brain is like some power-crazed CIA desk jockey who feeds you memories on a need-to-know basis only. Daniel Schachter, a Harvard memory researcher, says that when the brain remembers, it does so in a way that is similar to how an archaeologist reconstructs a past scene, relying on an artifact here, an artifact there. The end result might be informative and useful, but don't expect it to be perfect. This is important because those who don't know anything about how memory works already have one foot in fantasy land. Most people believe that our memory operates in a way that is similar to a video camera. They think that the sights, sounds, and feelings of our experiences are recorded on something like a hard drive in their heads. Totally wrong. When you remember your past, you don't get to watch an accurately recorded replay. Even knowing what I know about human memory, however, I continue to live as though my memories are reliable and accurate. One has to in order to function in daily life. Most of the time, it all works out fine, which is why the human brain does it this way. But it can be tough sometimes because I've peeked behind the curtain. I've seen the wizard. I know what's really going on in my head. No longer can I be absolutely sure about all the places I've been and the things I've done. For example, one special day long ago, I found the courage to kiss Kimberly, the most beautiful girl in my third grade class. Or did I? Did I really start that glorious day, as I remember, by giving her the note I had spent an hour crafting the night before, the one that asked her to be my girlfriend? I can see it in my head, right now. There was just one line, "Do you love me?" There were three boxes below it for her to check yes, no, or maybe. After the final bell that day, did I really man up, as I recall, and lean in with my little 8-year-old body to execute the most romantic kiss on the cheek in the history of all elementary schools? I can see the replay in mind, clear and in great detail. I'm confident that I remember it correctly, but did it really happen that way? Because of the way our brains work, I can't be sure, no matter how confidently my memories assure me that it did. Who knows? Maybe it did happen. But it was in fourth grade rather than third. Maybe it was Kimberly I dreamed of kissing, but it was another girl whom I kissed. Or worse, maybe I missed Kimberly's cheek and kissed a goat by accident while on a school field trip to a farm. Maybe my classmates ridiculed me for it on the long bus ride back to school. I don't remember anything like that happening, but perhaps that's because my brain edited and embellished a bitter memory to help me cope, all without consulting me first, of course. It's possible, because like it or not, that's how human brains work when it comes to memory. Was Kimberly a goat? I hope not, but short of photographic evidence of the big kiss or documentation from an official animal endangerment investigation, I'll never know for sure. Don't laugh at me. For all you know, there may be a goat or two in your past, since all human brains operate on a foundation of creative deception when it comes to memory. To try to make it easier for people to understand how memory really works, I describe it like this. Imagine a very tiny old man sitting by a very tiny campfire somewhere inside your head. He's wearing a worn and raggedy hat and has a long, scruffy gray beard. He looks a lot like one of those old California gold prospectors from the 1800s. He can be grumpy and uncooperative at times, but he's the keeper of your memories, and you are stuck with him. When you want or need to remember something from your past, you have to go through the old codger. Let's say you want to recall that time when you scored the winning goal in a middle school soccer match. You have to tap the old coot on the shoulder and ask him to tell you about it. He usually responds with something, but he doesn't read from a faithfully recorded transcript, doesn't review a comprehensive photo archive to create an accurate timeline, and doesn't double-check his facts before speaking. He definitely doesn't play a video recording of the game for you. Typically, he just launches into a tale about your glorious goal that won the big game. He throws up some images for you, so it's kind of like a lecture or slideshow. Nice and useful, perhaps, but definitely not reliable. Your memories are stories about your past. Without informing you, the old man might take it upon himself to leave out some parts of the story just because he feels they are unimportant. He also might get confused and accidentally toss in a few scenes from that horror film you watched last year. He's good at that. He can blend the past you are recalling with another past or an entirely made-up event in seamless ways that you probably won't catch. Also, as with most stories that are told and retold, the key elements, names, and imagery all change over time. With each telling, the facts and people can easily get shuffled or lost entirely. That's the reality. Your memories depend on the whims of an inconsistent and somewhat flaky storyteller. Don't get me wrong, I'm not condemning the old man. He does all this to try to be helpful to you, and it usually works just fine. It's the best way, most of the time, because we don't want or need to remember everything we see, hear, and experience in life. It's too much information, and a brain can only store and utilize so much. The key point to keep in mind is that when it comes to remembering very important or unusual things, such as a murder or alien abduction or a ghost sighting, the old man might not get it right, so we can't trust memory alone. I'll never forget that day. Yes, you will. Contrary to popular belief, even our memories of dramatic and unforgettable events are not reliable. This is hard for many of us to believe because we tend to assume that a big spectacular moment in our lives will be burned into our minds forever. Sorry, but that's just not true. Researchers have shown this repeatedly by doing things like asking people to write down where they were and who they were with when something big went down, such as the 9/11 attacks. They did this shortly after the event. Then, when asked the same questions again years later, many would confidently remember being with people and in places during the event that contradicted their earlier and presumably more accurate memories of the day. Perhaps the biggest memory problem that good skeptics need to be aware of is that recollections of real events can be altered or contaminated with false memories and imagination. False memories can even be implanted by other people. This can be done fairly easily, much to the horror of people who care about truth and reality. Memory researchers have shown that doing nothing more than mentioning a name or showing an image of something before asking someone to recall an event can significantly change how he remembers that event. For example, if I was going to test your recall of your first day of high school, I might casually chat with you beforehand and slip in a few comments about cold weather and snow. Then, during questioning about your first day in high school, I would ask, "Was it hot or cold that day?" Chances are you would answer cold, even if it had been hot. Yes, it can be just that easy to change a person's memory. Even more strange, it is possible to implant a completely fabricated memory into someone's brain, not just finesse an existing memory, but create an entire event. Again, this is not as difficult to do as you might think. By simply suggesting to someone that she was at a particular family picnic or party years ago, her brain might instantly conjure up a convincing memory of all the fun she had that day, even though she never made it to that particular event. People can end up with partially or totally manufactured memories inspired by films, novels, or stories they hear too. The cold hard truth is that our memories are highly vulnerable to being altered by suggestions, or just plain made up by the brain. You can't trust them completely. By the way, it's important to add that this has nothing to do with intelligence or mental health problems. It's just how normal, healthy brains work. So this is your memory, and don't forget it. Now you know that there are very good reasons to be skeptical when people say they remember extraordinarily weird things. They may be remembering accurately, but how can you know for sure? You have to ask for additional evidence. Unfortunately, most people in the world haven't heard about what scientific research has revealed about human memory. So they are too quick to trust the memories of other people as well as their own memories. Fortunately, you know better now. It doesn't make sense for us to believe unconditionally when someone claims to have witnessed a paranormal or supernatural event yesterday, last week, or last year. Even if someone happens to be the smartest, most trustworthy person in town, we would still need good evidence to confirm that her memory is an accurate account of what happened. The deceptive brain. Remembering the past accurately is not our only problem, far from it. We aren't very good at thinking straight about the present, either. We all have many natural biases that have stealthy ways of distorting our thinking. What we may imagine is a reliable and logical brain is more like a three-ring circus of wacky thinking. For example, did you know that we instinctively notice and remember evidence that supports our beliefs while simultaneously ignoring and forgetting evidence that contradicts our beliefs? It gets worse. We can look at a scene before us, convince ourselves that we are paying close attention to it, and then fail to notice important, unusual, or unexpected things present, even though they are right in front of our open eyes. Yes, just because you may be staring at something doesn't necessarily mean you see it. Our brains also compulsively connect dots in order to create meaningful images out of visual input. This can be a useful ability in some situations, but in others, it becomes a mental trap that causes us to see and believe in things that aren't there. These are only a few of the many problems we face when trying to figure out what's going on around us. You can go through life never knowing or caring about them, but why would you want to? Don't you want to give yourself the best chance possible to avoid mistakes in how you think and how you perceive the world around you? After years of researching skeptic topics and the natural workings of the human brain, I have a lot of empathy for people who believe weird things that almost certainly are not true. It's so common to the human condition to be snared by irrational beliefs that I feel very fortunate not to be running around somewhere right now searching for fairies, preparing for the mothership to land, or giving away half of my income to some psychic or faith healer. The good news for you is that just being aware of how your brain goes about its business greatly improves your chances of keeping both feet planted in reality. When you realize that your brain is playing its own game by its own rules, then you know better than to trust it unconditionally, and you are better prepared to take on the world. Forget eyes. It's the brain that sees. Let's take a look at vision. Have you heard the old saying, seeing is believing? Well, it's often a case of believing is seeing. It is well known by researchers that what we think we see can be strongly influenced by images and ideas we have been exposed to previously, as well as our own thoughts and imagination. This probably explains why it's the people who already believe in ghosts or UFOs who keep seeing ghosts or UFOs, and why so few non-believers do. Seeing things that are not there can happen to anyone because the human brain constructs and interprets the visual reality that is around it. What we see is something the brain has produced for us based on input it received via the eyes. It's never a 100% true and complete reflection of what our eyes are pointed at. For this reason, we can't always be sure about what we think we see. Yes, that might be an angel that you see up ahead. Or your brain could be showing you an angel that it has mistakenly constructed out of a bush or some other object. Construct and interpret reality? It sounds crazy when you think about it. We don't really see the things we look at? How can this be? Most people probably assume that the brain simply shows us or somehow faithfully relays whatever images come in through the eyes. But that's just not how it works. What actually happens is that light patterns enter the eyes and electrical impulses are sent along optic nerves to the brain. Then the brain translates these impulses into visual information that you see in your head. Your brain doesn't reflect or replay the scenery around you like a mirror or a camera and monitor would. It provides you with its own highly edited and customized sketch of the scene. Your brain gives you a version of what you look at. It's as if your brain comes up with something like a Hollywood movie production that is loosely based on what is really going on around you. You are not watching a video feed, you are watching a docudrama. The brain takes the liberty of leaving out what it assumes are unimportant details in the scene before your eyes. Just like memory, this is not necessarily bad most of the time. In fact, it's necessary in order to avoid information overload. You don't need to see every leaf and every tree and every blade of grass in full detail when you look around a park. That would be way too much data. It would clutter your thoughts and make you less efficient, if not incapacitate you. What you need in order to walk through a park and function well is to have a general picture of your surroundings, so that's what your brain gives you. If you need more detail, then your eyes and brain zoom in and focus on a single leaf or an individual blade of grass. It gets weirder. Not only do our brains leave out a tremendous amount of detail, they also routinely fill in gaps in our vision with images that you can't possibly see or that maybe don't even exist in reality at all. Your eyes might not be able to track a fast-moving object, for example, so your brain will sometimes conjure it up and show it to you anyway, figuring that it might be useful to you to see a projected version of reality. The brain also fills in missing elements that should be there in static scenes because, again, it can help us to navigate our way through the environment. Magicians have known about this for many years. Even if they don't understand or care about the science behind it, they take full advantage of the way our vision works when they do their sleight-of-hand coin tricks, for example. Again, our brains don't do any of this for a gag or to make fools of us. They do it because it is the most effective and efficient way to function in life most of the time. In addition to filling in missing images, our brains also find patterns or connect the dots when we look around. They do this automatically and do it very well. It helps us to see things that otherwise might be difficult or impossible to recognize. It's probably one of the main reasons you and I are alive right now. Like many other animals, our prehistoric ancestors relied on this ability to eat and to avoid being eaten. When they needed to spot well-camouflaged birds and rabbits hiding in the bushes in order to avoid starvation, this ability to see things through clutter was crucial. It was no less important, of course, for them to identify the vague outline of a predator hiding in ambush in order to avoid becoming dinner in the short term and avoid extinction in the long term. Although city dwellers rarely, if ever, find themselves in need of locating a predator lurking in the distance, this type of seeing still seems to be deeply ingrained. For example, a friend of mine who does long-distance open-water swims in the Caribbean told me that she does not suffer from shark paranoia, but regardless of how she feels about it, her brain doesn't take sharks lightly. When her head is underwater during long swims, she says her brain's visual system seems to be scanning constantly for the outline of sharks in the distance. And it often sees shark outlines if something even comes close to the shark template, she explained, although 95% of the time it's nothing, not even a fish. Michael Shermer, founding publisher of the excellent magazine Skeptic, has studied and written about this skill, habit, obsession of our brain for many years. He calls it patternicity, defined as the tendency to find patterns in meaningless noise. Shermer says our brains do this so often and so well that they ought to be thought of as pattern recognition machines. It's all good, of course, right up until patternicity starts pushing us beyond reality and causing us to see too many things that do not exist. That's when we get ourselves into trouble. If I were walking in a forest at sunset, and there was by chance a shadow that was vaguely shaped like a bear, my brain might instantly serve up a more complete and convincing image of a dangerous bear lurking in the dark. He's not there, but I just saw him. I swear I could even see his sharp teeth and menacing eyes. Now, if a bear really was there, my brain might have saved my life by alerting me. If no bear had been there, however, I was startled briefly, and it's no big deal. But what if I was certain I had seen Bigfoot, a demon, an alien, or a god? That might complicate my life unnecessarily, Shermer explains. Unfortunately, we did not evolve a baloney detection network in the brain to distinguish between true and false patterns. We have no error detection governor to modulate the pattern recognition engine. Thus, the need for science, with its self-correcting mechanisms of replication and peer review. But such erroneous cognition is not likely to remove us from the gene pool and would therefore not have been selected against by evolution. On the one hand, it makes sense for us to see some patterns of things that aren't really there in order to be very good at seeing real ones that matter. On the other hand, we need to be aware of this phenomenon because it can lead to a confident belief in things that are not real or true. Additionally, patternicity is not limited to vision. It impacts hearing and thinking, too. Good skeptics understand how the brain often creates false patterns. So we know to be very cautious when considering claims of UFO sightings, for example, or anything else that is unusual. It only makes sense to be skeptical and ask for additional evidence when people claim to have seen or heard extraordinary things. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Given what we now know about the brain, however, are you going to believe someone who tells you she saw a flying saucer or Bigfoot last week? She doesn't have to be lying to be wrong. Anyone with perfect vision can see poorly. Anyone with a bright brain can think and come to the wrong conclusions. Anyone with an excellent memory can have wildly inaccurate memories. The ape that wasn't there. As if all this weren't enough, we also have to be on guard against something called inattentional blindness. This fancy phrase is what scientists call it when people look right at something and think they are paying close attention, but really aren't seeing as well as they imagine. Inattentional blindness is the reason it's not safe to drive while talking on a phone. You can be staring wide-eyed at the road ahead of you, but as your brain devotes itself to the phone conversation, you fail to notice the truck that brakes in front of you or the motorcycle rider who pulls out in front of you. Scientists Christopher Chabris and Daniel Simons constructed a funny and effective experiment that shows just how easily inattentional blindness cripples our awareness. If you would like to take the test yourself, visit their website and view the brief video before reading the rest of this paragraph, www.theinvisiblegorilla.com/videos.ht.